Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 2018 was a huge year of uncertainty for people at Bloomington Normal's largest employer. State Farm insurance workers went through a lot of anxiety and turmoil as the company assessed numerous units at headquarters in Bloomington. Hundreds of workers were let go, promoted, transferred in and out, and it was unsettling for the community and for the workforce. Joe Strupek is a company spokesman. He joins us to talk about where State Farm is in its gigantic reinvention and reprioritization process and where it's going.
State Farm has been going through these changes for a number of years. It's not a matter of saying that we're starting or stopping. Over the past year in Bloomington, we had some restructures and some changes with some major departments that had some local impacts. Those are beginning to take effect as we go into 2019. But I would say that long term, as we look at Bloomington and we look at the country, we will continue to change and adapt as the customers' needs do and the marketplace demands.
The scope of the changes in Bloomington has been notable. And has aroused both public attention and internal employee concern. Is the scope of that change in Bloomington Normal going to continue?
The changes that you reference and the note, we can't diminish the impacts to individuals and families and friends, and I think that's what we heard in Bloomington. But as we go into 2019, the workforce numbers have consistently been around 15,000 for the past few years. Those are going to continue. The workforce numbers have remained stable. That is the distribution of the workforce between the paraprofessional, the professional, and management are the same with very little changes.
Let's talk about number of jobs in, number of jobs out. Assess the total picture in some metrics, would you?
We have moved employees in and out of Bloomington for a number of decades. When we had the regional office structure, at one point in time at the max, there were 28 different regional offices, and that's hundreds of offices and buildings around the country. We moved to the zone structure in 2000. Those number of buildings began to decrease, but we continued to move people in and out, and we've done it as we've gone to an enterprise-led structure. There's a misperception that the hubs were constructed to replace corporate headquarters and move folks from here to there, and that's incorrect. The reason the hubs were created was to tap into a different talent market and to bring large numbers of employees together. And so a number of those employees came from offices around the country. We've recently, within the past 2 years, announced that we're going to exit 13 of our large operation centers. And a number of those employees can compete for and go to the jobs in the hubs. So we continue to move people in and out through the career process to the hubs, just as we did in offices before. In relationship to size, our size has remained, as I said, relatively the same. Richardson is half the size of the corporate workforce, and each Arizona, the facility there and the one in Atlanta, is less than half the size of corporate.
So numbers in and out of Bloomington Normal.
I don't have those numbers. We don't track those. It fluctuates day in and day out.
You have been keeping track of the number of units who've been doing this reassessment and giving people hard news or good news depending on how they stack up and the needs of the company stack up, though. So you surely must have some sort of idea of the velocity of this year.
When you mention the velocity, I look at the total numbers. We look at the total numbers, and it going through 2018 and 2019 is going to remain around 15,000. The the distribution of employees has remained the same. The average salary in all levels has increased.
And by how much?
It varies across. It varies across the job levels.
When you say the average salary has increased, what are you talking about there?
The average salary, the percentage has increased for all levels, paraprofessional, the professionals, and for management. There's been an increase.
By other measurements, aggregates, how do you want to slice that?
The slice it is the percentage of increase. So it varies at different levels, but it has increased across the board.
Do you have an aggregate? Say the average payroll in Bloomington Normal has increased by X dollars or not?
No, I don't have that.
There's also, in addition to the overall number of people, there's a perception in the community that the top-level talent, the executive-level talent, may be diluted as part of this process, and that more of those folks will be in hubs than was the case. Can you address that?
For executives that are located here in Bloomington, we have executives located all around the country, but the number of executives in Bloomington, obviously the CEO and the C-suite is here, but for the total number, it has remained consistent for the past 8 years. The hubs aren't replacing corporate. That was not the intention. They're part of, there's 45,000 employees located outside of Bloomington. Those 45,000 used to be across hundreds of offices. And now that number of offices have decreased, and three of them are now much larger. We did that to tap a talent pool and attract portions of the workforce. We also did it because of the efficiencies of putting numbers of employees together, and that has impacted the business positively. But State Farm's corporate headquarters remains in Bloomington.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier about the overall rate of pay across all sectors and all divisions in Bloomington Normal increasing. Is it a matter of it increasing more than a usual cost of living increase, or that you would say, okay, these changes to increase efficiencies and performance in the company are because we're finding better people and paying them better and concentrating our efforts on the producers, or is it what normal business growth would suggest would happen with cost of living increases?
It's the jobs themselves. To remain competitive, we take a look at the salary ranges for jobs, and we will make adjustments to align ourselves with the marketplace. It is performance raises in combination with that, and you put all those together, and that lifts the salary base.
Is it above, significantly above cost of living, the salary base, because you're having to adjust to the industry as a whole, or is it, I'm trying to get to a matter of scale here, and I understand you may not have precise numbers or may not want to part with them for proprietary reasons, but go as far as you can, please.
It aligns with an increase across the board because of the jobs themselves and how those jobs price in the marketplace, but also performance evaluations as they go. We invest in employees. We want to attract and retain talent, and we compensate and provide benefits accordingly to do that. And that's for us to also remain competitive and attract that talent in the market.
Organizationally, big tech changes, market condition shifts, those prompt big adjustments to a lot of big business sectors and industries. Is the insurance industry collectively largely done with a big adjustment, or would you characterize what's happening here as an ongoing incremental adjustment that just looms large because it's concentrated in Bloomington Normal?
I think it's continual. I think for the insurance industry, the changes continue. I don't think there's a start and a stop. I think the changes that we've done from a technology standpoint, adapting to the marketplace, when you look at the customer needs, I think it's across all industries, and it's the impact to the changes outside. I don't think anybody can if we think about historically any industry. across the country. There are skeletons of businesses that didn't change. They changed too late or they made the wrong changes. And when those happened, those had at times impacts on the communities where they were, some more than others. So when we look at it, it's not a matter of start and stop. And I think with insurance, if you look at competitors, folks are entering the industry that haven't been in the industry before, and so the competitive landscape changes. I think we all have to react to that, and that's impacted State Farm here in Bloomington, but also all our other offices. The moves we made around the country to locations, the workforce, and the jobs was in reaction to those changes.
Contrast State Farm's approach to those changes, moving to hubs and away from regional offices and zone offices, to other insurance company efforts to do the same sort of reinvention.
I don't have knowledge of how each one of those competitors have changed. We have a distribution system that has primarily been based around the State Farm agent. And now, as we've gone forward through some of these changes, it is a mixture. The consumer needs are, at times, they want to work with a State Farm agent, and at times, they would like to do self-service. So our changes have allowed for an intermixture of that distribution system with a continual focus on the agent.
Since State Farm has a significant market share, it is probably a safe assumption to say that their customers are similar to other insurance company customers in their desires. If they really want to get service in whenever, wherever, however they want, whether it's online or through an agent or through an 800 number, how is this affecting the overall bottom line of the insurance industry and the overall infrastructure that companies have to put in place to stack up against the premium dollar, the administrative cost per premium dollar?
In the marketplace, one of the primary drivers of the choices for insurance companies is price. And so in speaking with State Farm, what we're doing is looking at more efficiencies and taking cost and expense out of the operation to compete more competitively on price. This past year, we've reduced rates all around the country. We did it in Illinois. That took Illinois, that's $65 million less in cost to the consumer. And that's where they look. And then at the time of service, it is how you respond to a claim. It is based on that customer demand. There are customers that want to talk to an agent to report a claim, and there are customers that would prefer to do that online. We don't want to limit ourselves to a customer base that just wants face-to-face contact or a customer base that wants to just do it online. We want to provide that across the board.
Industry-wide, how much is that increasing the overhead, though, if you have to have all these platforms rather than just pick one?
I don't have that information industry-wide. Okay. For a percentage.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joe Strupek of State Farm Insurance is our guest today. We're talking about the year in State Farm and trying to assess how things have shaken out in State Farm's reorganization, reprioritization over that year. Over the course of the year, there was buzz about several hundred people here, several hundred people there, people in this unit really worrying, people waiting for the shoe to drop in that unit about who would be severed and who would be asked to go somewhere else. Are we going to see the same sort of concentration on Bloomington Normal as the largest single collection of State Farm workers in the coming year? Is the pace of change going to remain the same?
What happened over the past year was focused on a number of departments that did it at the same time. When that happens, there are individuals, families who are impacted, coworkers. Those changes were concentrated in 2018. We don't see that concentration of changes going into 2019. The buzz, and we can't diminish that. Those are individual stories of impacts to people, and you can't diminish that. It's individuals, it's families, and we understand that there are impacts economically to individual businesses, but collectively, as we look at McLean County, we look at Bloomington, and we look at Normal, we have remained relatively the same through the year and going into 2019.
How do you try to address the buzz? How do you try to reassure people that things aren't exactly chicken littling here?
We talk to employees. We explain the changes, and it's a repetitive process. When people are impacted, there is an emotional reaction, and we can't downplay that, and we help them as much as we can understand the direction that we're going in the organization, the changes we're making, and why we're making those changes.
Have you seen the skittishness reduce? Have you seen your reassurances take hold, or are people still pretty unsettled?
Yes. There is less buzz internally within State Farm, and there is less buzz externally. I think that you and I have talked, and I appreciate the invitation here today. And one of the reasons why I'm here today is I think that we can always improve as we talk both inside and outside to explain what these changes are and what the overall impacts are.
Well, let's talk about some of the impacts to the company. Change and reassessment is often good for an organization if it's done well. What are you seeing so far in meaningful metrics improving State Farm's ability to serve customers, as you said, wherever and whenever they want it? How are you measuring that in ways that, of course, don't violate proprietary considerations?
We report externally on an annual basis, and we'll do that again in February. But the trends that we're seeing as we go through the year is an increase in net worth. Our growth as we go through these changes is begin to move in a positive direction. We're seeing a positive impact in expenses so that we are able to make investments in other areas. We made an announcement recently, a $100 million venture operation that will look at investing in new products and services, possibly even outside the insurance industry. Those are the type of things that we're able to focus on and do. But from a metrics, we're seeing positive changes.
Tell our listeners about that investment, would you?
We're looking at how we could better serve the customer and be more competitive. So taking a look at quite possibly are there startups and other organizations that we can work with for new products, or even looking at technology and help us serve and be more competitive.
This is Sound Ideas. Joe Strupek of State Farm Insurance is our guest. We're summing up the year in change at the company headquarters in Bloomington Normal. It used to be that with the mothership being the unchallenged center for State Farm, the talent pool here was very deep. Now, that had some benefits for the community in a lot of ways. Among them, the people involved in creating community, serving on boards, councils, volunteering, fundraising, participating in cultural arts. With the hubs now taking up a significant share of talented people, can the company do anything to encourage extra involvement of its workforce in community in Bloomington Normal to offset some of that shift out?
As it relates to philanthropy and community work, today as we talk, we're just a day out from a broadcast yesterday that we did with the entire workforce, a live broadcast. It's the end of the year around the CEO. And the focus of that was State Farm's philanthropic and community efforts across the country. That's Bloomington and the hubs and the other locations that we have. And through multiple programs, the matching gift program that we have where for a qualified tax deductible gift, State Farm will match up to $1,500, up to $3,000 for an educational institute. We have the Good Neighbor Grant program where employees will volunteer 40 hours to an organization and we will give $500 to that organization. That has remained consistent across the company, the participation. We've seen increases in giving with the matching gift. It is not something that is that we take lightly. You have 19,000 State Farm agents that are engaged in the community. Yesterday, in addition to the nonprofits in what would be the hub cities and also Bloomington, we highlighted our participation in places like Winter Haven, Florida, and DuPont, Washington. People in the employees in Bloomington continue to serve on boards. We're seeing a similar participation, dollar-wise and volunteer-wise, in groups as with the Good Neighbor grants and the matching gifts. And we continue to promote that. We have employees that sit on both the Bloomington and Normal Town Councils. There are employees that continue to participate in the boards of Unit 5 and District 87. So we continue to promote that. We have not seen, from our perspective, a difference. We don't track by individual that participation, but I think there's a very strong connection between the workforce here in Bloomington and the nonprofits and the community.
The fear is that that connection is going to be eroded by the hub system, that the change company structure creates a different dynamic for community involvement from the way things used to be done. It used to be send them out to a regional for a few years, bring them back when they're promotable, back out, back here, rinse and repeat till career peak. And they would form ties here at each iteration of their employment within Bloomington Normal, and they would pick up those ties when they came back. If they're not coming back, why get involved? Why view this place as home and a place to be involved? And sometimes this isn't their end destination. If they want to be in a hub, they're going to want to stay in a hub, and they're going to develop ties there and involvements there. Will they be less inclined to get involved in Bloomington Normal along the way to their career goals?
They're still coming back, and that that Bloomington to the hubs or other locations in the country, that will continue. The hubs weren't designed to be a final destination for State Farm employees and to not have talent housed here. So instead of somebody moving from Bloomington to a regional office and back again and back to another regional office and back, you will see, and we have had experience where somebody goes to a hub and they come back to Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
They go to another hub and they come back to Bloomington. So it's remaining the same.
Mayor Chris Cousteau of Normal said recently on our air that he doesn't think that the transfers in and out are as numerous as they used to be, that the pace of that, the velocity, if you will, has slowed compared to 15 years ago. And certainly the realty market would support that, although that's a cloudy tool because there are other factors affecting the realty market. So what's your take on and your assessment of how much transfer period is compared to what it was 10 years ago?
We don't track the velocity. I would not be able to speak to the increase or decrease in activity, and that would go that would fluctuate based on at the time what the needs were, where somebody needed to be, the talent alignment. But that will continue, even though there may be less going in and out. Our footprint here and our relationship with the community is relatively the same, and that includes that includes all level. And we continue to encourage folks to be involved in the community.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. I'm Charlie Schlinker. With us is Joe Strupik of State Farm Insurance. Let's talk about the downtown building in Bloomington. Prospects, Nibbles, where are you on trying to unload that landmark?
We're continuing to market. We continue to have interest, and we're still in that process.
What's the company's goal for it now that the initial marketing period has shaken out? Are you still looking for a single buyer or a consortium? How much are you willing to look for multiple buyers rather than one to get a sale? What's your process?
We're looking at all the options. We haven't limited to any particular individual or consortium. We're marketing the building, and we are open to consideration of any option.
How many nibbles have you had?
That I can't share.
So are you close to changing your intentions about going to a different disposition of that building or giving it away? Or
we're still looking at the sale of the building, and we're still talking to buyers about that.
The city has said it would really like to help with this. Have you involved them? What is their ability to facilitate a sale?
We have had conversations with the city all along through the process. And have talked to them and are looking at all options for the disposition of the building.
And how can they help?
Specifically, we're having conversations with them on all of that, and that's a conversation between us and the city.
State Farm Public Affairs spokesman Joe Strupek spoke with GLT before the holiday about the year past and the year ahead for Bloomington Normal's largest employer. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is GLT. Still to come, Eric Stock reports on how mindfulness training can help school kids get and stay ready to learn.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Sure, New Year's Eve parties can be a good time. You might get a few weeks of healthy eating in with a New Year's resolution, but the only end-of-the-year guarantee you can really count on? Lists. Best of lists. And GLT has a few of our own we'd like to share. Joining me in studio today are GLT Digital Content Director Ryan Denham and GLT Music Director John Norton with a sneak peek at our best of lists for 2018. Thanks for being here, guys.
You're welcome.
Hey, Charlie.
Ryan, let's start with you. You've compiled the top 10 most read stories of 2018 on WGLT.org. What made the list?
Well, number one on the list may not surprise you terribly, State Farm and the various changes we've seen at State Farm this year with restructuring of a lot of those IT jobs and layoffs, transfers out of town, that kind of thing, kind of pooled all those stories together, and that was definitely our most read of the year. Several local tragedies made the list, of course, the Normal West bus crash from a few weeks ago that killed the volunteer. That was certainly on the list as well. But I was pleased to see some other things pop up on that list. Mary Cullen's stories about a shortage of psychiatrists in town who are serving kind of the youngest patients made the list. Colleen Reynolds' piece about a mother, Ricky Lee Beneke, who lost her son to a heroin overdose. Those stories all made the top 10, and I was happy to see that some of our more important stuff had made the list. Real stories, not clickbait.
Popular doesn't necessarily mean important or impactful. Clicks are clicks. What about the other most important stories of 2018?
Well, that's what we tried to capture with this other list that we put together. We call it My Favorite Story of 2018. Our newsroom staff, you, me, John here, as well as folks in our development team, Melissa Liebert, Pat Peterson, everybody's putting together, choosing one story that they heard on GLT from this year and why it was their favorite. Some other stuff popped up that was kind of interesting. Our Rivian coverage throughout the year was in there. And this really sound-rich story about a Children's Discovery Museum and University Galleries joint program that Laura Kennedy did for us after retiring. That made the list, too. So some of the choices surprised me. I mean, John, you went with one of the American Anthem pieces from NPR, if you want to talk about that a little bit.
There were so many great stories. I do want to give Mary Cullen a shout-out, too, for the blacksmith story she did. I thought that was really cool. And Eric's football story up in Lexington. But I did choose that NPR story because it just moved me. It's a great series that NPR does about all these different anthems from over the decades.
What was the one that you chose again?
I chose Simon and Garfunkel's America Song. It deals with a lot of the same issues, or a lot of the same issues we're dealing with today, they were dealing with back in 1968 when that came out, and they had all these different voices from today talking about some of that, as well as some of the geography of America, but you got to hear it.
Well, let's do that right now.
Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come.
Realizing that everybody is looking for America, what does that mean? For me, getting to know America is more about the questions that we ask than the sort of sureness that we might reach in our own experience.
I don't know whether we ever did find it or whether this was just a quixotic quest, but I think all of us are still searching for America and hoping to find it and define it and give it meaning, and we all do that in our own way.
John Norton, every week you're introducing us to new artists on GLT's Sound Ideas as they come through local music venues. How do you decide who made the list for your best new local music of 2018?
Well, generally, it's the interviews that I did this year. I kind of started from there. Ryan asked me to do this, and I knew there were going to be people I missed or left off, so it made me nervous to do that. But the people that I interviewed this year, whether they're from Bloomington Normal or they were playing in town from outside of the Twin Cities, and from there I came up with a list of a lot of people that made some really good music this year.
Tell us a few.
Well, I think the big albums of the year from some of the better-known names in town, Something Brothers, reunited in 2017, and they had put out some songs on Bandcamp that year that I frankly thought, yeah, it's just okay. I was kind of like disappointed. And then they put out this album called Apollo in 2018, their first one in nearly three decades. And it's phenomenal. I've got like five different earworms from that album alone. And just the way the album started with a song called Fuzzle, it just sounded like a re-entry into the Bloomington Normal music scene by the Something Brothers.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Fuzzle. Anderson and Chicago Farmer both had some albums this year, and those made your list.
Yeah, they're the consensus leaders now of the Twin Cities music scene, and they both put out phenomenal albums. Edward David Anderson put out a song called album called Chasing Butterflies that is topping some national music charts right now, Americana charts. Fans of Becker Tirefire may not like me for this, but I think he's doing his best work of all time, and even this album I think tops his last album, which was incredibly good. And Chicago Farmer, a.k.a. Cody Decoff, finally released that live album that his fans have been asking for, and it's a double live, and it really captures the essence of who he is. It's hard to capture Cody's essence on a studio album because of his...
He's a storyteller.
Just a riveting storyteller, and the two albums might have been a little bit much, but he pulled it off. It's mesmerizing to hear how he introduces songs and ties those songs to real stories and real-life situations.
Those are established artists. How about some of the debut albums of note?
Well, I was knocked out by Leah Marlene's album. We just featured that a couple of weeks ago. She's a 17-year-old senior at, I think it's Normal Community, not Normal West, I might be wrong, one or the other. And her father, Derry Grant, is a member of Hollywood or Honeymoon Suite, the Canadian band that charted in America a couple of times in the 80s. And, well, the genes got passed on, and not only can she play guitar, but she can sing, and she can write music. This is phenomenal. Her album is called Arrow.
This is not a 17-year-old voice. Let's hear some of it. And other debut albums?
Jenny B is another one that surprised me because I didn't know who she was before I saw her cardboard sleeve album. And I'm like, okay, here's another local artist. I'll give it a listen. And like, whoa, she trained in opera, musical theater. I love the way her voice soars on this album. It's called Crickets and Honey. The reason we're not hearing a whole lot from her is she's got a couple of debilitating diseases that keep her from not only performing, but recording. But what a talent. And Flaccid, if I can give Flaccid a shout out, it wasn't a debut album, it was their finale album. And after 6 years, this psych rock band called it quits. Members are kind of going in different directions and that, and they put out a finale album that's really good as well.
How about the stuff you want to hear in 2019?
Oh!
So what's coming up?
There's a song out by Sherwood Forest called Glow. They put a single up on Spotify that is phenomenal. And if that's an indication of what we're going to get from a full album, I can't wait to hear that. I want to hear something new from Hot Sauce Universe. They haven't put something out for a few years. Jay and Janae Thomas, an incredibly talented husband and wife team. Matthew Curry, we featured some of these new songs. We're hoping to be on a new album in 2019. Wildermore, I want to hear a debut album from Wildermore. They covered David Bowie. They've covered The Who the last couple of years at the Silver Ball at the Castle Theater. I want to hear some original music from those guys. I'm guessing Stone and Snow might put something out this year. And I want to hear something new from the War Painted Horses. That's Michael Adams, and he put out a really great debut album. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago now, but we haven't heard from him. I want to hear an update.
Well, give us something to close the music part of this segment with. What are we going to hear?
The one thing I'd like to say is most of the artists I've already mentioned are kind of in that whole singer-songwriter vein. That seems to be the center of what Bloomington Normal music scene is right now. But it's a much more diverse scene than that in general. Poster Children put out an album in 2018, their first album in 14 years. That Champagne Urbana's band from the 1980s, they're kind of the equivalent of what the Something Brothers were back in Bloomington Normal in those days. But they were a punk-based band. Rose Marshack and Rick Valentin are the husband-wife team behind that band. They toured nationally in the 80s and 90s. They recorded on a major label, and now we're claiming them here in Bloomington Normal. They're our band now. Another one's Dirty Rotten Revenge. Now, this is a hardcore punk band, and that is part of the Bloomington Normal scene. There's also Stefan Robinson, who goes as Yay Big, and he has some little more out-there music, kind of a ambient, free jazz, avant-garde sound, and some interesting lyrics on some of his stuff. But that's all part of the scene as well.
Let's hear some of Yay Big to close out this music segment. Ryan Denham, WGLT.org, also has a best photo of 2018 gallery up. What made the cut there?
Well, a lot of great stuff, but what makes that photo gallery so cool, it's about 30 images, 35 images, is that the photos were largely taken by our student workers and our student interns here that come from Illinois State's School of Communication. Jeff Smoody, Cindy Lee, and Carly Gray, who actually graduated mid-year, just worked their tail off and have produced some really good stuff. They covered all the big elections this year, political protests, rallies, cute dog adoption events, tiny therapy horses going to help college students de-stress, artists creating their masterpieces. There's just some really good stuff that we've put together over the year with their help. You may have seen some of them over the year on Instagram. We share them out piecemeal, photo galleries at WGLT.org. But if you're looking for a fun way to spend 5-10 minutes flipping through these images, I can't recommend that gallery enough.
That's GLT Digital Content Director Ryan Denham and GLT Music Director John Norton. You can see these lists and more at WGLT.org. Just look for the Best of 2018 link on the homepage. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Support for GLT comes from SEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Educators are becoming increasingly concerned about students bringing anxiety to school every day. Whether they worry about families, food, or phones, kids are expected to set those things aside to learn. GLT's Eric Stock looks at a pilot program that is part of a growing trend in education. It tries to improve classroom performance by helping students become mentally and emotionally ready to learn.
Franny Corrigan is a junior basketball player at Illinois State University. Before she goes to bed every night, before each game, and any time she feels stressed, Corrigan goes through a meditation ritual. First, she sits or lies down.
And it kind of involves me just first, just like calming myself down, like preparing mentally to like, hey, okay, you're gonna do this for about 10 minutes. usually I need to have my hand, my palms facing up because you don't want to be all tense while you're doing it. And then usually close my eyes.
Corrigan does a mental body scan, senses each muscle, tightens and relaxes them from toe to head. It takes 10 minutes. She focuses on breathing deeply and calming herself. Corrigan says her teammates think it looks funny.
Some teammates are like, yeah, what are you doing? which is understandable. I mean, you kind of just see me sitting there, like, closing my eyes and deep breathing. It kind of looks a little funky.
Corrigan says she grew curious a couple years ago when the team brought in a sports psychologist to teach relaxation techniques, and she did her own research, too.
I've seen the benefits of it. I've seen, like, I know Kobe Bryant is really into it, and so I think just being able to see, like, other people have success with it and knowing that it's kind of up and coming now, I think is kind of beneficial.
Corrigan is studying exercise science at ISU and wants to be an athletic trainer so she can mentor other student-athletes. She says she wishes she could have learned mindfulness techniques before going to college. As it turns out, some K-12 schools are putting mindfulness in the classroom.
I'm awesome. You're awesome. We're all awesome.
Abby Lyons took her first teaching job at Sugar Creek Elementary in Normal last year. The certified yoga instructor takes some class time to teach about the brain, how it regulates emotions, and how kids can use that knowledge to empower themselves.
Our breath changes the way our brain works. The time that we take to just sit and breathe can be so helpful in creating a lot of space for us.
Lyon says it was a light bulb moment.
It was fascinating watching them take these strategies on.
When you are angry, it's like your brain is in this mode, and really literally your brain is in a mode that doesn't allow you to think about what's happening.
Lyon shared her findings with the Unified administrators and convinced Superintendent Mark Daniel to drop in on a class. Students demonstrated for him what's called roller coaster breathing, rolling your index finger up and down the other hand to simulate the timing of their breathing and how it calms them. Daniel created a social and emotional learning pilot program at Sugar Creek and Oakdale grade schools. He says it's time for a new way of thinking in schools.
The days of just saying, sit, be quiet, although we love to have those days back, those days aren't here. And now students question, they challenge, and I think if we asked our young parents that question, they would have the same response.
Lyons is in charge of the socio-emotional learning pilot. She visits 20 classrooms per week for a half hour each time, giving demonstrations to students and teachers.
This is my dream job, so when I think about like what I want to be doing with my life, it's this. It's supporting teachers, it's supporting students, it's supporting families with tools that physiologically change their brains to support them in feeling better, healthier, happier.
But meditation time eats into regular classroom time. Lyon says she's had pushback from some teachers about diverting precious classroom minutes away from the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. But Lyon says many kids are showing up what she calls dysregulated, not ready to learn.
There have been a lot of responses from our teachers in both buildings that say, you know what, if I wasn't doing circles at the beginning of my day connecting with my students, I would not have known that my student didn't sleep last night, and that's why their behavior looked like this during the day, and that's why they weren't focused on math during the day.
Superintendent Daniel considers time for socio-emotional learning time well spent.
We could teach 24/7. 365 days a week, but if a student isn't ready to learn, they're not going to learn. So therefore, that's wasted time. So we're moving the students to where they can truly be susceptible and ready to learn.
Some classroom teachers do see a difference. Lisa Hazelwinkle is in her 15th year of first grade at Oakdale Elementary.
If they're feeling upset or angry about something, they'll ask to use the calming corner where they'll go and just kind of lay down or sit down and take a break from everything for a few minutes. Using their words, expressing to their friends, you know, I don't like that when you do that, please stop. And just being kind, noticing when their friends are having some problems and being kind to them and being supportive. I'm noticing more of that.
Abby Lyons isn't the only educator who is taking the mind over matter approach to social and emotional well-being in Unit 5.
Take a 10-second deep breath in.
This is Patrick Palmier.
This time, slowly blow it out of your nose.
Palmier teaches phys ed at Grove Elementary in Normal.
This time, take a deep breath in through your nose.
At a recent weekend play day at the school, Mr. Palmier gave his students an elementary lesson in meditation.
Are you going to have a good or a bad day today here at Grove?
Good!
Raise your hand if you're going to have a good day. Raise your hand if you're going to help other gators if they don't know what to do. Raise your hand.
Palmier is a fitness guru who says he just started meditation about a year ago himself, and now he's made it a daily ritual that he shares with his students when time allows.
It's a simple question of, do you want to be happy or not? And to me, you know, 5-10 minutes a day to make your entire day better, it's worth it. So, you know, if I could meditate versus working out, I'm a huge advocate, obviously, of physical activity. If I could meditate versus work out, I'd probably meditate because I know my entire day is going to be better.
Two of Palmier's fourth grade students, Rowdy DeMonso and Campbell Damery, say they feel better prepared for the day when they take time to stop and take an emotional inventory.
It really helps me control self-control.
It calms me down so I'm not too hyper, and it makes me feel a little bit better, not as nervous.
Palmier says it helps to have an attitude of gratitude, and that can be self-fulfilling.
Some days we feel healthier than other days, so just being aware of that and understanding, okay, what can I think about, what can I be grateful for this day that can help me have a better day overall.
Schools typically need hard data to expand or justify programs. So far, that's limited. Socio-emotional learning instructor Abby Lyons says schools participating in the pilot have seen a drop in students being called to the office. The schools surveyed teachers before the school year and will be surveying them at the end of the year to measure progress. Lyons says her evidence of mindfulness impact is measured so far in anecdotes, such as this one when a first grader asked to address the class.
She said, "Raise your hand if you've ever seen your parents fight before." And so, you know, all the kids raised their hands, and she said, "Well, when your parents fight, you can take a deep breath to calm down, and then you can tell your parents to take a deep breath, and then they'll stop fighting."
Lyon says teachers are expected to mold young people while only being in their lives 10% of the time. She says this is how to affect the other 90%.
In that moment, I realized that this work has the power to actually stop trauma in its tracks if we can empower our kids to take it home.
Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel says Lyons could help change how teachers assess students' social and emotional needs, but schools aren't prepared to overhaul the system.
It will be a piece of our solution. It will not be in totality the solution.
At some point, you might have to put out an ad for a mindfulness teacher. Where do you find them?
I think we're growing our own in that area, but again, taking what she's bringing to this and then how do we resource that and so forth, that will be a challenge, exactly. Not all teachers can do this.
Lyons hopes to see more schools embrace the concept.
We have kids and adults who are showing up saying, "I came here angry, and I know that when I take a deep breath, I can show up and I can create space for myself to respond in a healthy way." That can change our entire school system, the entire way we operate. And when six-year-olds are able to speak that and recognize that, that's humongous.
I'm Eric Stock.
Bloomington High School has taken its own path to better connect with students' social and emotional needs by starting a 23-minute advisory period twice a week where students can meet with teachers and other advisors. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The year in Illinois politics saw a new governor elected, a very expensive campaign, a budget passed on time, and fallout from the Me Too movement. The Illinois Politics Roundtable chews on some of those topics. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Brian Mackey, Rachel Otwell, and Daisy Contreras, who says the expense of the race was mind-boggling.
Yes, the race for Illinois governor is considered one of the most expensive races, especially when we had one billionaire and one near-billionaire both running for the seat. Pritzker put in about $171 million of his own money, while Rauner put in about $70 million. Now, we don't know where the money went, if it was funneled into other races, but we can say that the money was a big talking point. And as reporters following the race, we weren't getting much from the candidates, but we were always wondering just how much money was coming in. Definitely made headlines across the country and was an issue of interest. Now, in the primaries, we saw this wasn't much of an issue for Rauner's opponent, State Representative Jeannie Ives, who was clearly outspent by Rauner, but who still managed to come in very close to winning.
Well, I guess when you get two uber wealthy people who really want to win, and there's question, of course, about Bruce Rauner, whether he wanted to be in this race or not. He still spent a lot of money. Charlie, your thoughts on just overall, is there a fallout from this going forward? I mean, is it now this is the bar that's set for how much money it's going to take to win the Illinois governor's race in future years?
I would certainly hope not. Although when the final campaign spending reports are filed, they're due on December 31st. The total amount spent on this governor's race, not just by Rauner and by Pritzker, but also by the other two candidates who are on the ballot in November, Cash Jackson, the Libertarian, Sam McCann, the conservative, plus all the people who ran, not just Jeannie Ives on the Republican side, but the half dozen or so Democrats who ran seeking the nomination that Pritzker already got, or ultimately got, will wind up having spent more money than ever before in U.S. history on a governor's race. And as I say, I hope it doesn't get to the point where you have to have this huge kind of campaign war chest, because it does two things, I think. One, it makes it harder for people of less than extravagant means to be able to run. Or if they want to run, they have to turn to the big bucks donors to try and get the money to pay for these kinds of campaigns. And as I say, I don't think it's good long term. Now, as somebody who's a longtime reporter, it's probably great for the TV stations that got all that negative ads. They got paid for that. It's good for the online promoters who got paid tons of money on all kinds of social media to run all these ads. But I don't think it's good for the citizens as a whole.
And it was fatiguing, Brian, I felt, during this year, because we started seeing, especially J.B. Pritzker, we started hearing ads from him almost a year before the primary.
Yeah, well, I'm in the fortunate position. This is going to sound snottish, but I don't actually watch a lot of TV that has commercials on it. I do watch a fair amount of PBS. I'm a bit of a nerd that way. But, you know, the DVR is also a great boon in this era. You can just fast forward right past those commercials. But, yes, if you were subjected to that, or if you use Facebook or Pandora or Spotify or any of the number of, you know, newer media, so-called new media outlets where you can be bombarded with ads, they were there. And that's what, I mean, when you spend the amount of money, as Daisy was talking about, the amount of money that these candidates had available to them, it's essentially limitless for the purposes of political advertising. You can be everywhere, and money is no object. And you know, it is, to Charlie's point, I thought he raised an interesting question about whether now we're going to be setting a pattern where you have to have a super rich candidate. And I think that one of the reasons Pritzker was so attractive to Democrats is that Governor Rauner was helping to lead a fight in Illinois that has been going on a long time across the country. And it's something else we saw happen this year, which is to weaken public employee unions. They are still one of the strongest, one of the only have been one of the only growing areas of the labor movement. And this year there was a case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, Janus versus AFSCME, that ended the so-called fair share fees, that the not union dues, but fees for services that state employees and other government employees who had to join, who didn't have to join the unions, but they had to pay the fees for the services the union provided, such as handling grievances, negotiating contracts and benefits and those sort of things. And that is, those unions, from a separate pool of money, have been a significant funding source for the Democratic Party. So as they were anticipating this decision, because it seemed fairly inevitable based on the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, they have been bracing themselves and looking for these rich candidates. And so now that you have a super rich Democratic candidate holding the governor's office in Illinois, you've got to imagine the Republicans are going to be looking for someone who can match him 4 years from now. And you do kind of get locked into this cycle. And in fact, our friend of the show, Chris Mooney, the political scientist at the University of Illinois Chicago, has identified this as a national trend. He calls them super rich neophytes. And something like a quarter of the people who were governor, at least before the election this year, are these ultra uber wealthy people. And many of them had never held political office before running for governor before.
Well, Daisy, I suppose if you wanted to look at it kind of cynically, it used to be that the rich guys would buy a baseball team or a basketball team. Now they want to buy an executive office.
Well, it goes beyond just money to me, though, because, I mean, the amount of money that Bruce Rauner put into this campaign would have been enough to, in many cases, win rather handily, you'd think. But his message, for whatever reason, didn't get through. He was an unpopular governor going into this race, and J.B. Pritzker won easily. So what it tells me also is, at least at this moment in time, Illinois is a very Democratic state, maybe more so than we even thought.
Yeah, I mean, even after the primaries, there was a lot of talk about the fence mending that each party needed to do with their respective base. But I believe Governor Rauner had the more difficult task. There was the obvious divide within the Republican Party after Rauner barely beat State Representative Jeannie Ives, who had substantial support from the more conservative Republican base. They were upset with Rauner after he signed into law legislation expanding public funding of abortions. And Ives herself said many times that conservative Republican voters felt betrayed and that many were not thinking about voting for him in the general election. So yes, to your point, Sean, Illinois is leaning more Democrat.
And Charlie and Brian, I'll bring you both in on this. The fact that Bruce Rauner was able to win 4 years ago, that was a bit of an anomaly in Illinois, too, because usually when somebody would win this, they have some type of public service background. Maybe they served in state government in some way, or they at least did something else that sort of put them in the public spotlight. Rauner winning, and of course, being a businessman and just coming in without that experience. And now J.B. Pritzker, the same thing.
Yeah, and I look back on the governors that I covered, starting with Richard Ogilvie, and they all had some background in public service, either at a local level. Ogilvie at one point was the sheriff of Cook County. He was then the county board president. Jim Thompson was a federal prosecutor. Jim Edgar was in the legislature. He was the secretary of state. George Ryan was in the legislature, secretary of state. Rod Blagojevich had been in the House and in Congress.
Pat Quinn.
Pat Quinn had been state treasurer, I believe, lieutenant governor. So they all had, they didn't start at the top as Rauner did. And I still believe that had Rauner unveiled his anti-union, pro-business agenda during the campaign 4 years ago, he would have lost to Pat Quinn. A lot of people voted for Bruce Rauner because he was not Pat Quinn. A lot of public sector employees were upset with Quinn because he pushed through what turned out to be unconstitutional legislation that would have reduced pension benefits. And so they voted for Bruce Rauner, who they didn't know a whole lot about, but they figured anybody's going to be better than Pat Quinn. Well, they were certainly wrong.
I will say, though, I'm not quite ready to write the obituary of the Illinois Republican Party. I mean, to be clear, they do have a very steep hill to climb. They are now in the super minority status in both the House and the Senate. And even more importantly, Democrats seem to have a firm grip on the map making process where they can help cement their majorities for the next 10 years, assuming that things don't change electorally in 2020 in terms of the, you know, a massive upset in the House and Senate. But having a Democrat in the governor's mansion for the redistricting process, which will happen in the 2021-22 legislative session, will be significant for Democrats. However, Governor Rauner went into this election, and he had made this case towards the end of the year. He talked about how he had tried to replace himself on the ballot because he, you know, basically saw the writing on the wall. And yes, President Trump, being as unpopular as he is in many populated parts of Illinois, certainly probably dragged Governor Rauner down. But Governor Rauner was uniquely unpopular because he was viewed as somebody who was basically bad at his job. Illinois, you know, 2 years of headlines of Illinois can't even get a budget, is not a good reelection platform. It's not a good place to start running for reelection. His popularity was really low. But if you have, you can still imagine, I think, in this state, and the model is set, was set in Illinois by people like Jim Edgar, George Ryan, who were relatively socially moderate, fiscally you know, ostensibly fiscally conservative, although you'll find Republicans today who would argue with that description. And then you also see people like the governor in Massachusetts now, who is a Republican and one of the most popular in the country. So there is still a model and a template out there. Let's remember that in 2010, a Republican almost beat Governor Pat Quinn. So I certainly think it's possible. It'll be harder in the legislature, again, because Democrats control the map-making process. But, you know, the next 4 years are going to involve some very difficult choices regarding taxes and dealing with the problems, the fiscal problems in state government. And that could make a challenging reelection environment for Governor Pritzker.
Sean Crawford moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable with Brian Mackey, Rachel Otwell, Daisy Contreras, all of IPR, and Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and Ryan Denham and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker.